sometimes we decide that we're going to really make something happen. And oftentimes when we want to make something happen, we decide the best thing we can do is hire the experts, hire the people who have already made something happen, and therefore we'll be assured of getting whatever it is we want really done. You know, in this highly political age in which we live, advertising geniuses and people who are able to take and put together a 30-second news clip or political TV advertisement that's really slick and really sharp. I think the idea is that we can elect about anybody that wants to be elected if we've just got enough money and get the right kind of people and put the thing together the right way. But this doesn't always work. And I think this is what the writer is telling us in the Bible this afternoon. And that is, just because we get all of our ducks in a row, because we get the smartest people in their field around a particular circumstance and put our time and money into it, that we can literally make it happen. And maybe the worst chagrined and embarrassed people in the United States at this particular time are the people who put the Hubble Space Telescope into orbit. Now they say, with the $1.5 billion that's been spent because of some technical error that's evidently rather minor, we can't see anything any better than we could from an Earth-based telescope. We thought, and I'm sure you read all of the advertisements and all of the glorying that people did and what a tremendous thing our scientific community had been able to accomplish, how wonderful it was. We were going to see things that we'd never seen before, and we were going to gain information that had been hidden from the eyes of man since whoever created the earth created it. And now everyone's red-faced and embarrassed because the best minds and all the money and all the things that went into it haven't benefited us this far, or thus far, hardly any. They say by 93 they may get one of the lenses, the lens changed, and by 96 when they send some more astronauts up to do a spacewalk and interchange some parts, then we may get a little more out of it. But I think really there's just almost a failure, a total failure. I think this is what happens when we think that we're in control. When we believe that man's mind and man's energy is the key to any circumstance, any situation. We've got enough money, we got enough influence, we can put enough pressure, and we can solve our problems. Well, here's what the Bible says. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift. Now we always assume that the race will be run by the man that can run the fastest. And if you have men standing in line to run a race, and you know the man that's the fastest, that's the man you're going to say will win. But that's not always so. The battle to the strong. That is, the people with the most ships, the people with the most men, the people with the most horses, people with the most tanks, most airplanes, they're not always the ones that win the battle. Nor yet bread to the wise. That is, there are wise men who go hungry. Nor yet riches to men of understanding. Here are men who have doctorates from the Harvard School of Business, And I understand that a master's degree from the Harvard School of Business is worth about $95,000, whether you've ever done anything or not. Just to have that degree and walk out into the world, pretty well assured of about close to $100,000 a year salary, just wherever you want to choose to work. But that doesn't mean that these men are always going to make money. There are people who have high degrees in finance who work for no more money than some of us receive. Nor yet favor to men of skill. That is, the artists, the painters, the sculptors, even though they're able to do things that common men without the gift could never accomplish, yet they're not always in favor. Sometimes they struggle as much or more than others. What's the answer? That is, what is the reason that sometimes the race is not won by the swift, nor the battle by the strong, nor wise men always having bread on their table? What is it that intercedes and intervenes to stop this from occurring as we might predict it? Well, two words are used here: time and chance. Give it enough time and get enough factors involved and things can go sour. And it can happen to you. It has happened to me more than once. And it can happen to you. You don't have to go bad. You don't have to decide you're not going to do that anymore. You don't have to say, okay, I want something bad to happen to me. Just give it enough time. Live long enough. Get involved in enough things. And time and chance will hand you your heartache. Time and chance will give you your defeat. And there'll be things that you didn't see. There'll be things you didn't think of. There'll be things that you might have decided to guard yourself against. But time and chance. Time and chance. They what? They happeneth to them all. And you can read any man's biography that's ever lived in this world, and he'll tell you that there were things happened to him that he never really planned on. You ask any woman in this world who's lived any length of time, and they'll tell you, there were things that happened to me that I never planned on. We have a lot of different things that sort of sum it up, and most gracious one is one that states there, but for the grace of God go I. The more blatant and perhaps practical ones are, as I've said a few times here, what goes around comes around. And this is exactly what the writer's saying. You may be the most skillful politician in the world, but someday something, time and chance, will happen. And you'll find yourself where everyone else is or where everyone else will be. It's just a matter of time and enough factors that can go wrong. They will go wrong. Because, see, there's so many things we can't control. You can't control the health of other people, and you can't control your own health. You can't control the economic circumstances of the world. You cannot control the economic circumstances of the own area in which you live. If you were to ask me to pick out a prime example of time and chance happening, I'd say Southwest Little Rock. One time, it was the fastest growing area in Arkansas. A town of 70,000 people. Most of them upper middle class. But time and chance happened to them all. Now when you say Southwest Little Rock, people just shake their heads as though you lived, and maybe it is, as though you lived in the cesspool of the world because of the perception and the image they have. But that's just, you say, but it's not that way. But that's the way things are if that's the way it is in people's minds. What happened? No one can really say 100%. Just time and chance. And you say, but I have planned and I am a very wise man and nothing like this shall ever happen to me. I have planned and I know what I'm doing. Well, you may and you may not. You may and you may not. Time and chance happeneth to them all. For man also knoweth not his time. That means you don't know when it's going to happen to you. As the fishes that are taken in an evil net. Now, fish are not aware of the net's existence. And as the birds that are caught in the snare. The birds simply are unaware of the snare. As the fish are unaware of the net. So are the sons of men snared in an evil time. Now notice that same word. When it falleth suddenly upon them. So now we know why the race is not always won by the fastest runner. Time and chance. Or why sometimes the weaker army wins. Why smart people don't always have enough to eat. Our skilled artisans are not always in favor. This wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great unto me. Now he wants to point out give an illustration really of sort of the thing that he's been stating here. And it has to do, of course, with a parable, or as we might state, with an illustration. There was a little city and few men within it. Now, first of all, there are two real disadvantages here in this circumstance that's described. First of all, there's a little city. Little cities didn't have much of an opportunity to defend themselves against the larger cities, because we're talking about a time in history when city-states, as we usually describe them, were the primary political unit. And strong cities dominated rather than strong states. Babylon was a city. You look at the Greek city, and they were the strong, dominating cities that were the powerful political unit. So he's really pointing out two serious problems here. Number one, a little city and just a few men. This was a circumstance of great danger. And he wants us to observe the action of wisdom and where it came from. There was a little city and few men within it. And there came a great king against it and besieged it and built great bulwarks against it. Here's a king who didn't want to take any chances. He sees the city. Perhaps he's unaware that there are few men in it, but he builds besieging instruments. Now there was found in it per wise man. I think the reason that he uses this definition or description is because poverty is generally despised. It's seldom that a poor man is respected in the society in which he lives, regardless of whatever wise saying or wisdom he might be able to display. I'm sure there are many, many untrained, that is, untrained from the viewpoint of the world, there are many just common men and women who live in the city of Little Rock that, had they been given an opportunity, could work out a good solid solution to the many problems that perplex our city. And it might be a person whose hands are dirty and oily from the kind of work he does, but see, we don't think that a person who involves himself in any kind of quote labor other than the use of his brain, he couldn't possibly have a good idea. Our solution would have to come from a doctor of sociology. It'd have to come out of the university system. And for it to really be wise, it'd have to come north of the Mason-Dixon line. I mean, real wisdom is up north. Have you ever noticed that? I mean, absolute, total wisdom is always north of wherever I happen to be anyway. We rarely ever ask poor people what they think. I worked before I started preaching a little while. I hope you catch the irony and sarcasms in that. But I did. I worked for a living once before I started preaching. And I worked in a small factory, and we did a lot of small items that had four or five different tiers to them. In other words, you had to cut the material and stack it in a certain way, and there was three or four procedures you had to go through in order to bring it to completion. And the superintendent, or the manager of the plant, would set up the material and the machine and even the way that the ladies or the operators sat, and he'd tell them, you know, place them in a certain way, now pick this up first, lay it here, pick this up, and then put the two together, and then turn it over and put it this way. And he had a degree from university in time and motion study. In other words, he was an expert in motion, in cutting down on wasted motion and getting everything where you could make a lot more things per minute than if you just sort of decided, well, this is a good way to do it. And one day, after we'd become very close friends, he said, "Do you want to stay around this afternoon? I've got to work on the new item we're trying to develop and find out how much it's going to cost, so I'll have to do a time and motion study and the cost, see what it is that you might be interested in." I was really interested in it. So we stayed there, and I did it, and he did it, and I did it one way, and he did it another way, and he had a stopwatch, and we figured, and he said, "Well, I think I know how I want to do it, but I'll let," and he named a lady, "I'll let her come over and see how she does it." And I said, "Why would you do that?" And he said, "Well, most of my ideas come from the people that work here. People who've had experience, they just look at it and sort of know how things ought to go and how fast it'll go." And he said, "A lot of times I ask the janitor, you know, do you see a lot of waste here?" And he'll look and say, "Yeah, if you'd cut this way and turn this way and turn that way, you wouldn't have near as much waste." And he said, "You know, he'd be right." And he taught me something. And that is, listen to people who don't have degrees and many times who are outside the field, because they may give you some of the best advice you ever had. But most of the time, you know, a poor man is just simply, he doesn't have any money and he doesn't have any brains. That's just sort of a, you know, the way mankind looks at it. If you got a lot of money, it must be because you have a lot of brains. Well, this was a poor man, but he was wise. And he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. I don't know how he did it. He had a plan, a procedure, and the city, in their need, already threatened with disaster and perhaps sure death, here comes a poor wise man who says, here's a solution to the problem. And everybody feeling like there's no other choice, they take the man's idea, they rely on his wisdom, and the city is delivered. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. Now what you can look at is that no one ever thought of him. No one thought of him before as being a wise man, and no one thought of him after as being a wise man. Now wisdom works, but it doesn't bring the benefits that you might think it brings. And I think this is sort of predicated on the position that Israel as a nation had before all the other nations of the Middle East. She was the poor, despised dispenser of wisdom. And all the other nations around her were a powerful group of people. And if they would listen to Israel and the wisdom that was in the nation of Israel, there could be spiritual power and spiritual deliverance. But normally, the nations around the nation of Israel despised the nation. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Dear people say from time to time, the world is hungry for the truth. That's not so. Never has been so. Never will be true until Jesus comes, when the nations thirst then for the word of God, and the knowledge of the Lord covers the earth as the waters cover the sea, when they're literally enmeshed and are immersed in the wisdom of God. Even then there'll be people who reject it. To be able to see through a thing and to give good advice will probably create many more enemies than it does friends. You would think that if you were a counselor, such as a marriage counselor, that in that profession, as you saw through the problems of married people and gave them their advice, that they would then turn in absolute love and gratitude toward you as one who gave them so many words of wisdom. But I can tell you, the person who has the fewest friends in the world is the counselor who's right most of the time. Why do you think Jesus kept saying, he that hath ears to hear, let him hear? And the parables of the sower, having ears to hear, they hear not, and having eyes to see, they see not. Socrates, a man of great earthly and worldly wisdom. I don't think there's ever been another man, and I don't include Jesus because he was more than a man, and Jesus and Socrates were not anything alike, okay? By birth, by anything. I'm just saying that as a wise man, I don't think there's been a man as wise as Socrates. I don't think Confucius was, and I don't think any of the pupils or disciples of Socrates was ever as wise as he was, Aristotle, Plato, or any of them. But you know what happened to Socrates? He was a wise man. And the society upon which he practiced his wisdom gave him the option of death or disgrace and banishment. They literally despised the man's wisdom. And it took several generations after he drank the hemlock before he became a popular philosopher. But now his words of wisdom are words that do not apply particularly to his generation, and therefore they're palatable. You know, if Jesus lived in this generation, he wouldn't be as popular with the religionists as he is, since he's dead and they're here outside his generation. You know, if Jesus' body presence, if he spoke his teachings to the modern church, they would despise him. But now, by using the Bible and picking a few verses here and there, they can claim the wisdom of Jesus. They can claim the discipline of Jesus. They can claim the attitudes of Jesus, and then do what they want to do, and that's quite satisfying. Wisdom's better than strength. He said, I saw that happen when the little city with a few men was delivered by one poor man's wisdom. But he said it has its drawbacks. Because they're despised. Do you think they took this poor man and made him president? Do you think they enthroned him and some beautiful home and said, you've delivered us with your wisdom, would you just be in charge of things from now on? Even though what he proposed saved their life, yet they despised him for what he had said and what he'd proposed. You have to think about that for a while to see the irony of it. The words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. He's simply saying there's two sources of advice, and one of them sort of the rantings and ragings of fools. The other is the wisdom of the man who offers it in quietness. And the idea is that when a wise man's words are heard, they affect the destiny of the people who hear them more than the cry of the fool. The wise man offers his advice in quietness. The fool cries his opposition. And even though he rules, his words seldom bring about the desired results. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. And he just illustrated that. Because here was a city under siege. Here were men defending it who were few in number. A man had built a weapon of war against it, the bulwarks, to lay siege to it and to besiege it. But wisdom was better than a weapon of war. It was better than a sword. It was better than whatever instruments there were that were going to be brought about it. But one sinner destroyeth much good. How is the connection there? Well, the idea is this, that one man can give a lot of good advice. It's based on wisdom, and it can save the city. But another man can offset that. And just as one man can do a lot of good, one man can do a lot of harm. In other words, it doesn't take an army of bad men. Paul said a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. One man can do a lot of good, one man can do a lot of harm. We ought to decide that we don't want to be the bad man that does a lot of harm. We ought to be a good man that does good. The energy of this verse is directed toward using wisdom. You know, many times we'd like to use our emotion as a gauge. You ever heard people say, well, I feel like this is the right thing to do? That's pretty well a key, that it's emotion. We need to be very careful of our emotions. Wisdom is not necessarily detached from emotion, but neither is it attached to emotion. No, there can be very wise things done that are without the emotional appeal that we usually like to have connected to whatever it is we do. But you know, sometimes we can feel that a thing is very, very right, or we can feel that it's very, very wrong, and throw our intensity and our influence into getting it done or to defeating it and getting it not done, and feel very good about it at the time we're doing it. Feel like this is the thing that I ought to do, and even feel martyr-like in it. And it may take a few years for us to look back on it and see it was a mistake. It wasn't wisdom at all. There was something else, maybe anger, maybe jealousy, maybe hatred. Who knows? We need to look at a thing very closely and measure it with the Word of God before we immediately say, that's not wise, we must not do that.